though he had spotted something fascinating and rare on a dung heap. Behind them, the waitress was bolting the doors. The sinking sun was throwing cold shadows across the street that Robin only knew was hot and smelly.
"Just being kind, were you, darling?" Whittaker asked softly,
and Robin could not tell whether there was more malice or sweetness in his voice.
"I suppose I was worried," said Robin, forcing herself to look into those wide apart eyes, "because Stephanie's injuries look quite serious."
"There," said Whittaker, putting out a hand to Stephanie's purple and grey face. "Come off a push bike, didn't you, Steph? Clumsy little cow."
Robin suddenly understood Strike's visceral hatred for this man. She would have liked to hit him too.
"I hope I'll see you again, Stephanie," she said.
She did not dare give the girl a number in front of Whittaker. Robin turned and began to walk away, feeling like the worst kind of coward. Stephanie was about to walk back upstairs with the man. She ought to have done more, but what? What could she say that would make a difference? Could she report the assault to the police? Would that constitute an interference with Carver's case? Only when she was definitely out of sight of Whittaker did she lose the sensation that invisible ants were crawling up her spine. Robin pulled out her mobile and called Strike.
"I know," she said, before Strike could start telling her off. "It's getting late, but I'm on my way to the station right now, and when you've heard what I've got, you'll understand."
She walked fast, chilly in the increasing cool of the evening, telling him everything that Stephanie had said.
"So he's got an alibi," said Strike slowly.
"For Heather's death, yes, if Stephanie's telling the truth, and I honestly think she is. She was with him and the whole of Death Cult, as I say. She definitely said Whittaker was there while she was servicing the band."
"I think so. She was just answering that when Whittaker turned up and... Hang on." Robin stopped and looked around. Busy talking, she had taken a wrong turning somewhere on the way back to the station. The sun was setting now. Out of the corner of her eye, she thought she saw a shadow move behind a wall.
"Cormoran?"
"Still here."
Perhaps she had imagined the shadow. She was on a stretch of unfamiliar residential road, but there were lit windows and a couple walking along in the distance. She was safe, she told herself. It was all right. She just needed to retrace her steps.
"Everything okay?" asked Strike sharply.
"Fine," she said. "I've taken a wrong turn, that's all."
"Where are you exactly?"
"Near Catford Bridge Station," she said. "I don't know how I've ended up here."
She did not want to mention the shadow. Carefully, she crossed the darkening road so that she would not have to walk past the wall where she had thought she had seen it, and after transferring her mobile into her left hand, she took a tighter hold of the rape alarm in her right pocket.
"I'm going back the way I came," she told Strike, wanting him to know where she was.
"Have you seen something?" he demanded.
"I don't... maybe," she admitted. Yet when she drew level with the gap between houses where she had thought she had seen the figure, there was nobody there. "I'm jumpy," she said, speeding up. "Meeting Whittaker wasn't fun. There's definitely something nasty about him."
"Where are you now?"
"About 20 feet away from where I was the last time you asked me. Hang on, I can see a street name. I'm crossing back over. I can see where I've gone wrong. I should have turned..."
She heard the footsteps only when they were right behind her. Two massive black-clad arms closed around her, pinning hers to her sides, squeezing the air from her lungs. Her mobile slipped out of her hand and fell with a crack onto the pavement.
Chapter 52. Do not envy the man with the X-ray eyes. Blue Oyster Cult, X-ray eyes. Strike, who had been standing in the shadow of a warehouse in Bow, keeping watch on Blondin Street, heard Robin's sudden gasp, the thud of the mobile on the pavement, and then the scuffling and skidding of feet on asphalt. He began to run.
The phone connection to Robin was still open, but he could hear nothing. Panic sharpened his mental processes and obliterated all perception of pain as he sprinted down a darkening street in the direction of the nearest station. He needed a second phone.
"Need to borrow that, mate,"
he bellowed at a pair of skinny black youths walking towards him, one of whom was chuckling into a mobile.
"Crime's being committed. Need to borrow that phone."
Strike's size and his aura of authority, as he pelted towards them, made the teenager surrender the phone with a look of fear and bewilderment.
"Come with me,"
Strike bellowed at the two boys, running on past them towards busier streets where he might be able to find a cab, his own mobile still pressed to his other ear.
"Police!"
Strike yelled into the boy's phone as the stunned teenagers ran alongside him like bodyguards.
"There's a woman being attacked near Catford Bridge Station. I was on the line to her when it happened. It's happening right... No, I don't know the street, but it's one or two away from the station. Right now. I was on the line to her when he grabbed her. I heard it happen. Yeah, and fucking hurry."
"Cheers, mate,"
Strike panted, throwing the mobile back into the hands of its owner, who continued to run alongside him for several yards without realizing that he no longer needed to. Strike hurtled around a corner. Bow was a totally unfamiliar area of London to him. On he ran past the Bow Bells pub, ignoring the red-hot jabs of the ligaments in his knee, moving awkwardly with only one free arm to balance himself, his silent phone still clamped to his ear. Then he heard a rape alarm going off at the other end of the line.
"Taxi!"
he bellowed at a distant glowing light.
"Robin!"
he yelled into the phone, sure she could not hear him over the screeching alarm.
"Robin, I've called the police. The police are on their way. Are you listening, you fucker?"
The taxi driver had driven off without him. Drinkers outside the Bow Bells stared at the lunatic hobbling past at high speed, yelling and swearing into his phone. A second taxi appeared.
"Taxi! Taxi!"
Strike bellowed, and it turned, heading towards him, just as Robin's voice spoke in his ear, gasping.
"Ah! You there!
Jesus Christ, what's happened?
Stop shouting!"
With enormous difficulty, he modulated his volume.
"What's happened?"
"I can't see," she said. "I can't see anything."
Strike wrenched open the back door of the cab and threw himself inside.
"Catford Bridge Station, hurry." "What do you mean you can't? What's he done to you?" "Not you,"
he bellowed at the confused cabbie.
"Go, go."
"No, it's your bloody rape alarm stuff in my face. Oh, shit!"
The taxi was speeding along, but Strike had to physically restrain himself from urging the driver to floor it.
"What happened? Are you hurt?"
A bit. There are people here."
He could hear them now, people surrounding her murmuring, talking excitedly amongst themselves.
"Hospital,"
he heard Robin say, away from the phone.
"Robin? Robin!
Stop shouting,"
she said.
"Listen, they've called an ambulance. I'm going to..."
"What's he done to you?"
"Cut me. Up my arm. I think it'll need stitching. God, it stings."
"Which hospital? Let me speak to someone. I'll meet you there."
Strike arrived at the Accident and Emergency Department at University Hospital Lewisham 25 minutes later, limping heavily and wearing such an anguished expression that a kindly nurse reassured him that a doctor would be with him shortly.
"No,"
he said, waving her away, as he clumped towards the reception desk.
"I'm here with someone. Robin Ellicott, she's been knifed."
His eyes travelled frantically over the packed waiting room, where a young boy was whimpering on his mother's lap, and a groaning drunk cradled his blooded head in his hands. A male nurse was showing a breathless old lady how to use an inhaler.
"Strike, yes, Miss Ellicott said you'd be coming,"
said the receptionist, who had checked her computer records with what Strike felt was unnecessary and provocative deliberation.
"Down the corridor and to the right, first cubicle."
He slipped a little on the shining floor in his haste, swore, and hurried on. Several people's eyes followed his large, ungainly figure, wondering whether he was quite right in the head.
"Robin? Fucking hell."
Scarlet spatters disfigured her face. Both eyes were swollen. A young male doctor, who was examining an 8-inch wound in her forearm, barked,
"Out until I've finished."
"It isn't blood,"
Robin called, as Strike retreated behind the curtain.
"It's the damn spray stuff in your rape alarm."
"Stay still, please," Strike heard the doctor say.
He paced a little outside the cubicle. 5 other curtain beds hid their secrets along the side ward. The nurse's rubber soles squeaked on the highly polished grey floor. God, how he hated hospitals. The smell of them, the institutional cleanliness underlaid with that faint whiff of human decomposition, immediately transported him back to those long months in Sellyoak after his leg had been blown off. What had he done? What had he done? He had let her work, knowing the bastard had her in his sights. She could have died. She should have died. Nurses rustled past in their blue scrubs. Behind the curtain, Robin gave a small gasp of pain, and Strike ground his teeth.
"Well, she's been extremely lucky," said the doctor, ripping the curtains open 10 minutes later. "He could have severed the brachial artery. There's tendon damage, though, and we won't know how much until we get her into theatre."
He clearly thought they were a couple. Strike did not put him right.
"She needs surgery."
"To repair the tendon damage," said the doctor, as though Strike were a bit slow. "Plus, that wound needs a proper clean. I want to x-ray her ribs as well." He left. Bracing himself, Strike entered the cubicle.
"I know I screwed up," said Robin.
"Holy shit. Did you think I was going to tell you off?"
"Maybe," she said, pulling herself up a little higher on the bed. Her arm was bound up in a temporary crepe bandage. "After dark, I wasn't paying attention, was I?"
He sat down heavily beside the bed on the chair that the doctor had vacated, accidentally knocking a metal kidney dish to the floor. It clanged and rattled. Strike put his prosthetic foot on it to silence it.
"Robin, how the fuck did you get away?"
"Self-defense," she said.
Then, correctly reading his expression, she said crossly,
"I knew you didn't believe I'd done any." "I did believe you," he said. "But Jesus fucking Christ."
"I had lessons from this brilliant woman in Harrogate, who was ex-army," said Robin, wincing a little as she readjusted herself on her pillows again. "After, you know what."
"Was this before or after the advanced driving test?"
"After," she said.
"Because I was agoraphobic for a while. It was the driving that really got me back out of my room, and then, after that, I did self-defense classes.
The first one I signed to was run by a man, and he was an idiot," said Robin. "All judo moves and just useless. But Louise was brilliant."
"Yeah?" said Strike.
Her composure was unnerving him.
"Yeah," said Robin. "She taught us it's not about clever throws when you're an ordinary woman. It's about reacting smartly and fast. Never let yourself get taken to a second location. Go for the weak spots and then run like hell." He grabbed me from behind, but I heard him just before he got to me. "I practiced it loads with Louise. If they grab you from behind, you bend over."
"Bend over," repeated Strike numbly.
"I had the rape alarm in my hand. I bent right over and slammed it into his balls. He was wearing tracksuit pants. He let go for a couple of seconds, and I tripped on this damn dress again. He pulled out the knife. I can't remember exactly what happened then. I know he cut me as I was trying to get up. But I managed to press the button on the alarm, and it went off, and that scared him. The ink went all over my face, and must have gone in his as well, because he was close to me. He was wearing a balaclava. I could hardly see. But I got in a good jab at his carotid artery as he bent over. That's the other thing Louise taught us. Side of the neck. You can make them collapse if you do it right. And he staggered, and then I think he realized people were coming, and he ran."
Strike was speechless.
"I'm really hungry," said Robin.
Strike felt in his pockets and pulled out a Twix.
"Thanks."
But before she could take a bite, a nurse escorting an old man past the foot of her bed said sharply,
"Kneel by mouth, you're going to theatre."
Robin rolled her eyes and handed the Twix back to Strike. Her mobile rang. Strike watched, dazed, as she picked it up.
"Mum."
"Hi,"
said Robin. Their eyes met. Strike read Robin's unexpressed desire to save her mother, at least temporarily, from what had just happened. But no diversionary tactics were necessary, because Linda was gabbling without allowing Robin to speak. Robin laid the mobile on her knees and switched it to speakerphone, her expression resigned. "Let her know as soon as possible, because Lily of the Valley is out of season, so if you want it, it'll be a special order."
"Okay,"
said Robin. "I'll skip Lily of the Valley." "Well, it would be great if you could call her directly and tell her what you do want, Robin, because it isn't easy being the intermediary. She says she's left you loads of voicemails."
"Sorry, Mum," said Robin. "I'll call her."
"You're not supposed to be using that in here," said a second cross nurse.
"Sorry,"
said Robin again.
"Mum, I'll have to go. I'll speak to you later."
"Where are you?" Linda asked.
I'll ring you later,"
said Robin, and cut the call. She looked at Strike and asked,
"Aren't you going to ask me which of them I think it was?"
"I'm assuming you don't know," said Strike. "If he was wearing a balaclava and your eyes were full of ink..."
"I'm sure about one thing," said Robin. "It wasn't Whittaker. Not unless he changed into sweatpants the moment I left him. Whittaker was wearing jeans and his physique wasn't right. This guy was strong but soft, you know? Big, though. As big as you."
"Have you told Matthew what's happened?"
"He's on his..." He thought, when her expression changed to one of near horror, that he was about to turn and see a livid Matthew bearing down upon them. Instead, the dishevelled figure of Detective Inspector Roy Carver appeared at the foot of Robin's bed, accompanied by the tall, elegant figure of Detective Sergeant Vanessa Equenzi. Carver was in shirt sleeves. Large wet patches of sweat radiated out from his armpits. The constantly pink whites of his bright blue eyes always made him look as though he had been swimming in heavily chlorinated water. His thick, greying hair was full of large flakes of dandruff. "How are you?" began Detective Sergeant Equenzi, her almond-shaped eyes on Robin's forearm. But Carver interrupted with an accusatory bark.
"What have you been up to then, eh?"
Strike stood up. Here, at last, was the perfect target for his so far suppressed desire to punch somebody, anybody, for what had just happened to Robin, to divert his feelings of guilt and anxiety onto a worthy target.
"I want to talk to you," Carver told Strike. "Equenzi, you take a statement."
Before anyone could speak or move, a sweet-faced young nurse stepped obliviously between the two men, smiling at Robin. "Ready to take you to X-ray, Miss Ellicott," she said. Robin got stiffly off the bed and walked away, looking back over her shoulder at Strike, trying to convey warning and restraint with her expression.
"Out here," Carver growled at Strike.
The detective followed the policeman back through A&E. Carver had commandeered a small visitor's room where, Strike assumed, news of imminent or actual death was conveyed to relatives. It contained several padded chairs, a box of tissues on a small table, and an abstract print in shades of orange.
"I told you to stay out of it," Carver said, taking up a position in the middle of the room, arms folded, feet wide apart.
With the door closed, Carver's body odour filled the room. He did not stink in the same way as Whittaker, not of ingrained filth and drugs, but of sweat that he could not contain through the working day. His blotchy complexion was not improved by the overhead strip lighting. The dandruff, the wet shirt, the mottled skin, he seemed to be visibly falling to pieces. Strike had undoubtedly helped him on his way, humiliating him in the press over the murder of Lula Landry.
"Sent her to stake out Whittaker, didn't you?" asked Carver, his face growing slowly redder as though he were being boiled. "You did this to her." "Fuck you," said Strike.
Only now, with his nose full of Carver's sweat, did he admit to himself that he had known it for a while. Whittaker was not the killer. Strike had sent Robin after Stephanie because, in his soul, he had thought it the safest place to put her. But he had kept her on the streets, and he had known for weeks that the killer was tailing her. Carver knew that he had hit a nerve. He was grinning.
"You've been using murdered women to pay off your fucking grudge against your stepdaddy," he said, taking pleasure in Strike's rising colour, grinning to see the large hands ball into fists.
Carver would enjoy nothing more than running Strike in for assault. They both knew it.
"We've checked out, Whittaker. We checked all three of your fucking hunches. There's nothing in any of them. Now you listen to me."
He took a step closer to Strike. Though a head shorter, he projected the power of a furious, embittered but powerful man, a man with much to prove and with the full might of the force behind him. Pointing at Strike's chest, he said,
"Stay out of it. You're fucking lucky you haven't got your partner's blood on your hands. If I find you anywhere near our investigation again, I'll fucking run you in. Understand me?"
He poked his stubby fingertip into Strike's sternum. Strike resisted the urge to knock it away, but a muscle in his jaw twitched. For a few seconds they eyeballed each other. Carver grinned more widely, breathing as though he had just triumphed in a wrestling match. Then strutted to the door and left, leaving Strike to stew in rage and self-loathing. He was walking slowly back through A&E when tall, handsome Matthew came running through the double doors in his suit, wide-eyed, his hair all over the place. For the first time in their acquaintanceship, Strike felt something other than dislike for him.
"Matthew," he said.
Matthew looked at Strike as though he did not recognize him.
"She went for an X-ray," said Strike. "She might be back by now. That way," he pointed.
"Why she need
ribs," said Strike.
Matthew elbowed him aside. Strike did not protest. He felt he deserved it. He watched as Robin's fiancé tore off in her direction, then, after hesitating, turned to the double doors and walked out into the night. The clear sky was now dusted with stars. Once he reached the street, he paused to light a cigarette, dragging on it as Wardle had done, as though the nicotine were the stuff of life. He began to walk, feeling the pain in his knee now. With every step, he liked himself less.
"Ricky!"
bawled a woman down the street, imploring an escaping toddler to return to her as she struggled with the weight of a large bag.
"Ricky, come back!"
The little boy was giggling manically. Without really thinking what he was doing, Strike bent down automatically and caught him as he sped towards the road.
"Thank you,"
said the mother, almost sobbing her relief as she jogged towards Strike. Flowers toppled off the bag in her arms.
"We're visiting his dad. Oh, God."
The boy in Strike's arms struggled frantically. Strike put him down beside his mother, who was picking up a bunch of daffodils off the pavement.
"Hold them,"
she told the boy sternly, who obeyed.
"You can give them to Daddy. Don't drop them."
"Thanks," she said again to Strike, and marched away, keeping a tight grip on the toddler's free hand. The little boy walked meekly beside his mother now, proud to have a job to do, the stiff yellow flowers upright in his hand like a scepter. Strike walked on a few paces, and then, quite suddenly, stopped dead in the middle of the pavement, staring as though transfixed by something invisible hanging in the cold air in front of him. A chilly breeze tickled his face as he stood there, completely indifferent to his surroundings, his focus entirely inward. Daffodils. Lily of the valley. Flowers out of season. Then the sound of the mother's voice echoed through the night again.
"Ricky, no!"
and caused a sudden explosive chain reaction in Strike's brain, lighting a landing strip for a theory that he knew, with the certainty of a prophet, would lead to the killer. As the steel joists of a building are revealed as it burns, so Strike saw in this flash of inspiration the skeleton of the killer's plan, recognizing those crucial flaws that he had missed, that everyone had missed, but which might, at last, be the means by which the murderer, and his macabre schemes could be brought down. Chapter 53. You see me now a veteran of 1,000 psychic wars. Blue Oyster Cult, veteran of the psychic wars. It had been easy to feign insouciance in the brightly lit hospital. Robin had drawn strength, not merely from Strike's amazement and admiration at her escape, but from listening to her own account of fighting off the killer. She had been the calmest of them all in the immediate aftermath of the attack, consoling and reassuring Matthew when he began to cry at the sight of her ink-stained face and the long wound in her arm. She had drawn strength from everyone else's weakness, hoping that her adrenaline-fueled bravery would carry her safely back to normality, where she would find a sure footing and move on unscathed, without having to pass through the dark mire where she had lived so long after the rape. However, during the week that followed, she found it almost impossible to sleep, and not only because of the throbbing of her injured forearm, which was now in a protective half-cast. In the short doses she managed at night or by day, she felt her attacker's thick arms around her again, and heard him breathing in her ear. Sometimes the eyes she had not seen became the eyes of the rapist when she was 19, pale, one pupil fixed. Behind their black balaclava and gorilla mask, the nightmare figures merged, mutated, and grew, filling her mind day and night. In the worst dreams, she watched him doing it to somebody else and was waiting her turn, powerless to help or escape. Once the victim was Stephanie, with her pulverized face. On another unbearable occasion, a little black girl screamed for her mother. Robin woke from that one shouting in the dark, and Matthew became so worried about her that he called in sick to work the following day so that he could stay with her. Robin did not know whether she was grateful or resentful. Her mother came, of course, and tried to make her come home to Masson. "You got 10 days until the wedding, Robin. Why don't you just come home with me now and relax before I want to stay here?" said Robin. She was not a teenager anymore. She was a grown woman. It was up to her where she went, where she stayed, what she did. Robin felt as though she were fighting all over again for the identities she had been forced to relinquish the last time a man had lunged at her out of the darkness. He had transformed her from a straight-A student into an emaciated agoraphobic, from an aspiring forensic psychologist into a defeated girl who agreed with her overbearing family that police work would only exacerbate her mental problems. That was not going to happen again. She would not let it. She could barely sleep, she did not want to eat, but furiously she dug in, denying her own needs and fears. Matthew was frightened of contradicting her. Weakly he agreed with her that there was no need for her to go home. Yet Robin heard him whispering with her mother in the kitchen when they thought she could not hear them. Strike was no help at all. He had not bothered to say goodbye to her at the hospital, nor had he come to see how she was doing, merely speaking to her on the phone. He too wanted her to go back to Yorkshire, safely out of the way.
"You must have a load of stuff to do for the wedding."
"Don't patronize me," said Robin furiously.
"Who's patronizing?"
"Sorry," she said, dissolving into silent tears that he could not see, and doing everything in her power to keep her voice normal. "Sorry. Uptight. I'm going home on the Thursday before. There's no need to go earlier." She was no longer the person who had lain on her bed staring at Destiny's Child. She refused to be that girl. Nobody can understand why she was so determined to remain in London, nor was she ready to explain. She threw away the sundress in which he had attacked her. Linda entered the kitchen just as Robin was shoving it into the bin. "Stupid bloody thing," said Robin, catching her mother's eye. "I've learned that lesson. Don't run surveillance in long dresses." She spoke defiantly. "I'm going back to work. This is temporary." "You're not supposed to be using that hand," said her mother, ignoring the unspoken challenge. "The doctor said to rest and elevate it."
Neither Matthew nor her mother liked her reading about the progress of the case in the press, which she did obsessively. Carver had refused to release her name. He said he did not want the media descending on her, but she and Strike both suspected that he was afraid that Strike's continued presence in the story would give the press a delicious new twist. Carver versus Strike all over again. In fairness, Strike said to Robin over the phone. She tried to limit herself to one call to him a day.
That's the last bloody thing anyone needs. It won't help catch the bastard.
Robin said nothing. She was lying on her and Matthew's bed, with a number of newspapers that she had bought against Linda and Matthew's wishes spread around her. Her eyes were fixed on a double-page spread in the Mirror, where the five supposed victims of the Shacklewell Ripper were again pictured in a row. A sixth black silhouette of a woman's head and shoulders represented Robin. The legend beneath the silhouette read, 26-year-old office worker escaped. Much was made of the fact that the 26-year-old office worker had managed to spray the killer with red ink during the attack. She was praised by a retired policewoman in a side column for her foresight in carrying such a device, and there was a separate feature on rape alarms over the page. "You've really given up on it?" she asked.
"It's not a question of giving up," said Strike.
She could hear him moving around the office, and she wished she were there, even if only making tea or answering emails.
"I'm leaving it to the police. A serial killer's out of our league, Robin. It always was."
Robin was looking down at the gaunt face of the only other woman who had survived the killing spree. Lila Monkton, prostitute. Lila, too, knew what the killer's pig-like breathing sounded like. He had cut off Lila's fingers. Robin would only have a long scar on her arm. Her brain buzzed angrily in her skull. She felt guilty that she had got off so lightly. "I wish there was something..."
"Drop it," said Strike.
He sounded angry, just like Matthew.
"We're done, Robin. I should never have sent you to Stephanie. I've let my grudge against Whittaker colour my judgment ever since that leg arrived, and it nearly got you." "Oh, for God's sake," said Robin impatiently.
"You didn't try and kill me, he did. Let's keep the blame where it belongs. You had good reason for thinking it was Whittaker. The lyrics. Anyway, that still leaves..."
"Carver's looked into Lang and Brockbank and he doesn't think there's anything there. We're staying out of it, Robin."
10 miles away in his office, Strike hoped that he was convincing her. He had not told Robin about the epiphany that had occurred to him after his encounter with the toddler outside the hospital. He had tried to contact Carver the following morning, but a subordinate had told him that Carver was too busy to take his call and advised him not to try again. Strike had insisted on telling the irritable and faintly aggressive subordinate what he had hoped to tell Carver. He would have bet his remaining leg that not a word of his message had been passed on. The windows in Strike's office were open. Hot June sunshine warmed the two rooms, now devoid of clients, and soon, perhaps, to be vacated due to an inability to afford the rent. Two times his interest in the new lap dancer had petered out. Strike had nothing to do. Like Robin, he yearned for action, but he did not tell her that. All he wanted was for her to heal and be safe.
"Police still in your street?"
"Yes," she sighed. Carver had placed a plainclothes officer in Hastings Road around the clock. Matthew and Linda took immense comfort in the fact that he was out there. "Cormoran, listen. I know we can't..."
"Robin, there is no we just now. There is me sitting on my arse with no work, and there's you staying at bloody home until that killer's caught."
"I wasn't talking about the case," she said. Her heart was banging hard and fast against her ribs again. She had to say it aloud or she would burst. "There's one thing we, you, can do then. Brockbank might not be the killer, but we know he's a rapist. You could go to Elisa and warn her she's living with..."
"Forget it," said Strike's voice harshly in her ear. "For the last fucking time, Robin, you can't save everyone. He's never been convicted. If we go blundering in there, Carver will string us up."
There was a long silence.
"Are you crying?"
Strike asked anxiously, because he thought her breathing had become ragged.
No, I'm not crying, said Robin truthfully.
An awful coldness had spread through her at Strike's refusal to help the young girls living in Brockbank's vicinity.
I'd better go. It's lunch, she said, though nobody had called her.
Look, he said, I get why you want...
Speak later, she said, and hung up.
There's no we just now. It had happened all over again. A man had come at her out of the darkness and had ripped from her not only her sense of safety, but her status. She had been a partner in a detective agency. Or had she? There had never been a new contract. There had never been a pay rise. They had been so busy, so broke, that it had never occurred to her to ask for either. She had simply been delighted to think that that was how Strike saw her. Now even that was gone, perhaps temporarily, perhaps forever. There's no we anymore. Robin sat in thought for a few minutes, then got off the bed, the newspapers rustling. She approached the dressing table where the white shoebox sat, engraved with the silver words Jimmy Choo, reached out a hand, and stroked the pristine surface of the cardboard. The plan did not come to her like Strike's epiphany outside the hospital, with the exhilarating force of flame. Instead, it rose slowly, dark and dangerous, born of the hateful enforced passivity of the past week, and out of ice-cold anger at Strike's stubborn refusal to act. Strike, who was her friend, had joined the enemy's ranks. He was a 6'3" ex-boxer. He would never know what it was like to feel yourself small, weak, and powerless. He would never understand what rape did to your feelings about your own body, to find yourself reduced to a thing, an object, a piece of fuckable meat. Sahara had sounded 3 at most on the telephone. Robin remained quite still in front of her dressing table, staring down at the box containing her wedding shoes, thinking. She saw the risks plainly spread beneath her, like the rocks and raging waters beneath a tightrope walker's feet. No, she could not save everyone. It was too late for Martina, for Sadie, for Kelsey, and for Heather. Lila would spend the rest of her days with 2 fingers on her left hand and a grisly scar across her psyche that Robin understood only too well. However, there were also 2 young girls who faced God knows how much more suffering if nobody acted. Robin turned away from the new shoes, reached for her mobile, and dialed a number she had been given voluntarily, but which she never imagined she would use. Chapter 54. And if it's true it can't be you, it might as well be me. Blue Oyster Cult, spy in the house of the night. She had 3 days in which to plan, because she had to wait for her accomplice to get hold of a car and find a gap in his busy schedule. Meanwhile, she told Linda that her Jimmy Choos were too tight for her, the style too flashy, and allowed her mother to accompany her as she exchanged them for cash. Then she had to decide what lie she was going to tell Linda and Matthew to buy sufficient time away from them to put her plan into action. She ended up telling them that she was to have another police interview. Insisting that Shankar remain in the car when he picked her up was key to maintaining that illusion, as was getting Shankar to pull up alongside the plainclothes policeman still patrolling their street and telling him that she was off to get her stitches out, which in reality would not happen for another 2 days. It was now 7 o'clock on a cloudless evening, and apart from Robin, who was leaning up against the warm brick wall of the Eastway Business Centre, the scene was deserted. The sun was making its slow progress towards the west, and on the distant misty horizon, at the far end of Blondin Street, the orbit sculpture was rising into existence. Robin had seen plans in the papers. It would soon look like a gigantic candlestick telephone wrapped in its own twisted cord. Beyond it, Robin could just make out the growing outline of the Olympic Stadium. The distant view of the gigantic structures was impressive and somehow inhuman. Worlds and worlds away from the secrets she suspected were hidden behind the newly painted front door she knew to be Elisa's. Perhaps because of what she had come to do, the silent stretch of houses she was watching unnerved her. They were new, modern, and somehow soulless. Barring the grandiose edifices being constructed in the distance, the place lacked character and was devoid of any sense of community. There were no trees to soften the outlines of the low, square houses, many of them sporting to-let signs. No corner shop, neither pub nor church. The warehouse against which she was leaning, with its upper windows hung with shroud-like white curtains and its metal garage doors heavily graffitied, offered no cover. Robin's heart was thudding as though she had been running. Nothing would turn her back now. Yet she was afraid. Footsteps echoed nearby, and Robin whipped around, her sweaty fingers tight on her spare rape alarm. Tall, loose-limbed and scarred, Shanker was loping towards her, carrying a Mars bar in one hand and a cigarette in the other.
"She's coming," he said thickly.
"Are you sure?" said Robin, her heart pounding faster than ever. She was starting to feel light-headed.
"Black girl, two kids, coming up the road now. Seen her when I was buying this," he said, waving the Mars bar. "Want some?"
"No, thanks," said Robin.
Do you mind getting out of the way?"
"Sure you don't want me to come with you?"
"No," said Robin. "Only come if you see him.
You sure the cunt's not already in there?"
"I rang twice. I'm sure he's not."
"I'll be round the corner then,"
said Shanker laconically, and he ambled off, alternately taking drags on his cigarette and bites of his Mars bar, to a position out of sight of Elisa's door. Robin, meanwhile, hurried off down Blondin Street so that Elisa would not pass her as she entered the house. Drawing in beneath the overhanging balcony of a block of dark red flats, Robin watched as a tall black woman turned into the street, one hand gripping that of a toddler and trailed by an older girl whom Robin thought must be around 11. Elisa unlocked the front door and let herself and her daughters inside. Robin headed back up the street towards the house. She had dressed in jeans and trainers today. There must be no tripping, no falling over. The newly reconnected tendons throbbed beneath the cast. Her heart was thumping so hard that it hurt as she knocked on Elisa's front door. The older daughter peeped out of the bow window to her right as she stood waiting. Robin smiled nervously. The girl ducked out of sight. The woman who appeared less than a minute later was, by any standards, gorgeous. Tall, black, and with a bikini model's figure, she wore her hair in waist-length twists. The first thought that shot through Robin's mind was that if a strip joint had been prepared to fire Elisa, she must indeed be a tricky character.
"Yeah?"
she said, frowning at Robin.
"Hi,"
said Robin, her mouth dry.
"Are you Elisa Vincent?"
"Yeah.
Who are you?"
"My name's Robin Ellicott," said Robin, her mouth dry.
"I wonder, could I have a quick word with you about Noel?"
"What about him?" demanded Elisa.
"I'd rather tell you inside," said Robin.
Elisa had the wary, defiant look of one perpetually braced to take the next punch life was going to throw her.
"Please, it's important," said Robin, her tongue sticking to the roof of her mouth because it was so dry.
"I wouldn't ask otherwise."
Their eyes locked.
Elisa's a warm caramel brown, Robin's a clear grey-blue. Robin was sure that Elisa was going to refuse. Then the thick-lashed eyes widened suddenly, and a strange flicker of excitement passed over Elisa's face, as though she had just experienced a pleasurable revelation. Without another word, Elisa stepped backwards into the dimly lit hall and made a strangely extravagant flourish, pointing Robin inside. Robin did not know why she felt a lurch of misgiving. Only the thought that the two little girls were in there pushed her over the threshold. A minuscule hall opened onto the sitting room. A TV and a single sofa constituted the only furnishings. A table lamp sat on the floor.
There were two photographs in cheap gilt frames hanging on the wall, one showing chubby Zahara, the toddler, who was wearing a turquoise dress with matching butterfly clips in her hair, the other of her big sister in a maroon school uniform. The sister was the image of her beautiful mother. The photographer had not managed to induce a smile. Robin heard a lock being turned on the front door. She turned, her trainers screeching on the polished wood floor. Somewhere nearby, a loud ping announced that a microwave had just finished its work.
"Mama," said a shrill voice.
"Angel," shouted Elisa, walking into the room. "Get it out for her."
"All right," she said, arms folded. "What do you want to tell me about Noel, then?"
Robin's impression that Elisa was gloating over some private piece of intelligence was reinforced by the nasty smirk that disfigured the lovely face. The ex-stripper stood with her arms crossed so that her breasts were thrust up like the figurehead of a ship, the long ropes of hair hanging to her waist. She was taller than Robin by 2 inches.
"Elisa, I work with Cormoran Strike. He's a..."
"I know who he is," said Elisa slowly. The secret satisfaction she seemed to have gleaned from Robin's appearance had suddenly gone.
"He's the bastard that give Noel epilepsy.
Fuck you, Noel.
You've got to him, have you? In it together, are you?
Why didn't you go to the pigs, you lying bitch, if he really..."
She smacked Robin hard in the shoulder, and before Robin could defend herself, began punching her with every subsequent word.
"Done. Anything. To. You."
Elisa was suddenly pummeling her wherever she could land a punch. Robin threw up her left arm to defend herself, trying to protect her right, and kicked out at Elisa's knee. Elisa shrieked in pain and hopped backwards. From somewhere behind Robin, the toddler screamed, and her older sister came sliding into the room.
"Fucking bitch!" screamed Elisa. "Attacking me in front of my kids!"
And she launched herself at Robin, grabbing her hair and slamming her head into the curtainless window. Robin felt Angel, who was thin and wiry, trying to force the two women apart. Abandoning restraint, Robin managed to land a smack to Elisa's ear, causing her to gasp in pain and retreat. Robin seized Angel under the armpits, swung her out of the way, put her own head down, and charged at Elisa, knocking her backwards onto the sofa.
"Leave my mum! Leave my mum alone!"
shouted Angel, grabbing Robin's injured forearm and yanking it so that Robin too yelled in pain. Zahara was screaming from the doorway, a sippy cup of hot milk held upside down in her hand.
"You're living with a paedophile!"
Robin roared over the racket, as Elisa tried to push herself back off the sofa to renew the fight. Robin had imagined herself imparting the devastating news in a whisper, and watching Elisa crumble in shock. Not once had she visualized Elisa looking up at her and snarling.
"Yeah, whatever. Do you think I don't know who you are, you fucking bitch? Are you not happy ruining his fucking life?"
She launched herself at Robin again. The space was so small that Robin hit the wall again. Locked together, they slid sideways into the TV, which toppled off its stand with an ominous crash. Robin felt the wound on her forearm twist and let out another shriek of pain.
"Mama! Mama!"
wailed Zahara, while Angel seized the back of Robin's jeans, hampering her ability to fend Elisa off.
"Ask your daughters!"
shouted Robin, as fists and elbows flew, and she tried to twist free of Angel's stubborn grip.
"Ask your daughters whether he's... Don't you dare fucking bring my kids! Ask them! Lying fucking bitch! You and your fucking mother!"
"My mother?"
said Robin, and with an almighty effort, she elbowed Elisa so hard in the midriff that the taller woman doubled over and collapsed onto the sofa again.
"Angel, get off me!"
Robin roared, wrenching the girl's fingers off her jeans, sure that she had seconds before Elisa returned to the attack. Zahara continued to wail from the doorway.
"Who?"
Robin panted, standing over Elisa.
"Do you think I am?"
"Very fucking funny," gasped Elisa, whom Robin had winded. "You're fucking Brittany, phoning him and persecuting him."
"Brittany?"
said Robin in astonishment.
I'm not Brittany.
She yanked her purse out of her jacket pocket.
Look at my credit card. Look at it. I'm Robin Ellicott, and I work with Cormoran Strike.
The fucker who gave him brain damage.
Do you know why Cormoran went to arrest him?
'Cause his fucking wife framed...
Nobody framed him. He raped Brittany, and he's been sacked from jobs all over the country because he interferes with little girls. He did it to his own sister. I've met her.
Fucking liar!
Shouted Elisa, making to get up from the sofa again.
I am not lying!
Roared Robin, shoving Elisa back against the cushions.
You mad bitch, gasped Elisa. Get out of my fucking house.
Ask your daughter whether he's hurt her. Ask her.
Angel? Don't you dare talk to my kids, you bitch!
Angel, tell your mother whether he's...
The fuck's going on?
Zahara had been screaming so loudly that they had not heard the key in the lock. He was massive, dark-haired and bearded, wearing an all-black tracksuit. One eye socket was sunken, caved in towards his nose, making his stare intense and unnerving. His dark, shadowed eyes on Robin, he bent down slowly and picked up the toddler, who beamed and cuddled close to him. Angel, on the other hand, shrank backwards into the wall. Very slowly, his eyes on Robin, Brockbank lowered Zahara into her mother's lap.
Nice to see you,
he said with a smile that was no smile, but a promise of pain. Cold all over, Robin tried to slide her hand discreetly into her pocket for her rape alarm, but Brockbank was on her in seconds, seizing her wrist and compressing her stitches.
You're fucking phoning no one, sneaky little bitch. Thought I didn't know it was you, didn't you?
She tried to twist away from him, her stitches pulling under his grasp, and shrieked,
Shanker!
I should have fucking killed you when I had the chance, lad bitch.
And then came a splintering crash of wood that was the front door caving in. Brockbank released Robin and whirled around to see Shanker hurtling into the room, knife to the fore.
Don't stab him! Gasped Robin, clutching her forearm.
The six people crammed into the small bare box of a room froze for a fraction of a second, even the toddler clinging to her mother. Then a thin voice piped up, desperate, trembling, but liberated at last by the presence of a scarred, gold-toothed man whose tattooed knuckles were tight around a knife.
He done it to me. He done it to me, Mummy did. He done it to me.
What? Said Elisa, looking towards Angel. Her face was suddenly slack with shock.
He done it to me. What that lady said. He done it to me.
Brockbank made a small convulsive movement, swiftly curbed as Shanker raised his knife, pointing it at the bigger man's chest.
You're all right, babes,
Shanker said to Angel, his free hand shielding her, his gold tooth glinting in the sun falling slowly behind the houses opposite.
He ain't gonna do that no more, you fucking nonce,
he breathed into Brockbank's face.
I'd like to skin ya.
What you talking about, Angel?
Said Elisa, still clutching Zahara, her face now a study in dread.
He never.
Brockbank suddenly put his head down and charged Shanker like the flanker he had once been. Shanker, who was less than half his width, was knocked aside like a dummy. They heard Brockbank pushing his way past the caved-in door as Shanker, swearing furiously, gave chase.
Leave him! Leave him!
Robin screamed, watching through the window as the two men streaked off down the street.
Oh, God! Shanker! The police will...
Where's Angel? Elisa had already left the room in pursuit of her daughter, leaving behind her the much-tried toddler to wail and scream on the sofa. Robin, who knew she could not hope to catch the two men, felt suddenly so shivery that she dropped into a crouch, holding her head as waves of sickness passed over her. She had done what she had meant to do, and she had been aware all along that there would almost certainly be collateral damage. Brockbank escaping or being stabbed by Shanker had been possibilities she had foreseen. Her only present certainty was that she could do nothing to prevent either. After taking a couple of deep breaths, she stood up again and moved to the sofa to try to comfort the terrified toddler. But unsurprisingly, given that Robin was associated in the little girl's mind with scenes of violence and hysteria, Zahara screamed harder than ever and lashed out at Robin with a tiny foot.
"I never knew," said Elisa. "Oh, God, oh, God. Why didn't you tell me, Angel? Why didn't you tell me?"
Evening was drawing in. Robin had turned on the lamp, which threw pale grey shadows up onto the magnolia walls. Three flat, hunchbacked ghosts seemed to crouch on the back of the sofa, mimicking Elisa's every movement. Angel was curled, sobbing, on her mother's lap, as the pair of them rocked backwards and forwards. Robin, who had already made two rounds of tea and had cooked spaghetti hoops for Zahara, was sitting on the hard floor beneath the window. She had felt obliged to stay until they could get an emergency joiner to fix the door that Shankar had shouldered in. Nobody had yet called the police. Mother and daughter were still confiding in each other, and Robin felt like an interloper, yet could not leave the family until she knew that they had a secure door and a new lock. Zahara was asleep on the sofa beside her mother and sister, curled up with her thumb in her mouth, one chubby hand still clutching the sippy cup.
"He said he'd kill Zahara if I told you," said Angel into her mother's neck. "Oh, sweet Jesus," moaned Elisa, tears splattering down her daughter's back. "Oh, sweet Lord."
The ominous feeling inside Robin was like having a bellyful of crawling, prickle-footed crabs. She had texted her mother and Matthew to say that the police needed to show her more photo fits, but both were getting worried about her long absence, and she was running out of plausible reasons to stop them coming to meet her. Again and again she checked the mute button on her phone, in case somehow she had stopped it ringing. Where was Shankar? The joiner arrived at last. Once Robin had given him her credit card details to pay for the damage, she told Elisa that she had better get going. Elisa left Angel and Zahara curled up together on the sofa and accompanied Robin out into the dusky street.
"Listen," said Elisa.
There were still tear tracks down her face. Robin could tell that Elisa was unused to thanking people.
"Thanks, all right," she said,
almost aggressively.
"No problem," said Robin. I met him at fucking church. I thought I found a good bloke at last, you know. He was really good with the kids."
She began to sob. Robin considered reaching out to her, but decided against it. She was bruised all over her shoulders where Elisa had pummeled her, and her knife wound was throbbing more than ever.
"Has Brittany really been phoning him?" Robin asked.
"'S what he told me," said Elisa, wiping her eyes on the back of her hand.
"He reckoned his ex-wife framed him, got Brittany to lie. Said if ever a young blonde bird turned up, she was talking shit and I wasn't to believe anything she said."
Robin remembered the low voice in her ear.
"Do I know you, little girl?"
He had thought she was Brittany. That was why he had hung up and never called back. "I'd better be off," said Robin, worried about how long it would take her to get back to West Ealing. Her body ached all over. Elisa had landed some powerful blows.
"You'll call the police, right?"
"I suppose," said Elisa. Robin suspected that the idea was a novel one to Elisa.
"Yeah."
As Robin walked away in the darkness, her fist clenched tightly around her second rape alarm, she wondered what Brittany Brockbank had found to say to her stepfather, and thought she knew. "I haven't forgotten. Do it again and I'll report you." Perhaps it had been a salve to her conscience. She had been frightened that he was still doing to others what he had done to her, but could not face the consequences of a historical accusation. "I put it to you, Miss Brockbank, that your stepfather never touched you, that this story was concocted by yourself and your mother. Robin knew how it worked. The defence barrister she had faced had been cold and sardonic, his expression vulpine.
You were coming back from the student bar, Miss Ellicott, where you had been drinking, yes? You had made a public joke about missing the, attentions of